Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the U.S. and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly. That makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the UK. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the US. We're now in relative decline too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back? Or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years, and humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline. And as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week. But join me again here next time on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Former White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham said on Thursday that former President Donald Trump watched the Capitol riot unfold gleefully on 6th of January, proudly rewinding footage of the insurrection on his television. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist John Skolnick and has been published by the website alternet.org. The piece is titled, Trump's former spokesperson says that he was gleefully rewinding Capitol riot footage on 6th of January. Stay with us for more. Former White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham said on Thursday that former President Donald Trump watched the Capitol riot unfold gleefully on 6th of January, proudly rewinding footage of the insurrection on his television. All I know about that day was that he was in the dining room, gleefully watching on his television, as he often did, look at all of the people fighting for me, hitting rewind, watching it again. That's what I know, Stephanie Grisham told CNN's New Day program. Her remarks, made on the anniversary of the riot, aligned with past reports about Donald Trump apparently glued to the television screen as the riot played out. Last year, Washington Post reporter Carol Lenig said in a CNN interview that the president was in the dining room of the Oval Office during the insurrection, watching it and almost giddy. But Trump's glee was reportedly not unanimous amongst his inner circle, according to recent findings by the House committee charged with investigating the insurrection. Over the past several weeks, the panel unearthed a trove of text messages from numerous Trump allies, including Fox News hosts and members of his own family, pleading with former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to have the president call off the insurgency. He's got to condemn this as soon as possible. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough, Donald Trump's son, Donald Jr., texted Mark Meadows at the time. Donald Trump's son, Don Jr., went on to add, "We need an Oval Office address. He has to leave now. It has gone too far and gotten out of hand." On Wednesday, 5th of January 2022, Stephanie Grisham, who resigned immediately after the riot, met with the January 6th panel to discuss Donald Trump's complicity in the riot, telling reporters that she fully cooperated with the panel's questioning. The meeting was in large part set up by the Select Committee member, Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, who reportedly privately called Stephanie Grisham and encouraged her to meet with the committee, according to CNN. Grisham said that the committee was specially interested in the White House's internal activities during the insurrection. On Thursday, 6th of January 2022, Stephanie Grisham said that more than a dozen ex-Trump confidants are planning to stage an intervention with the former president. Next week, a group of former Trump staff are going to come together, administration officials are going to come together, and we're going to talk about how we can formally do some things to try and stop him, and also the extremism, that kind of violence, rhetoric that has been talked about and continues to divide our country, Stephanie Grisham told CNN's New Day. Stephanie Grisham said that about 15 of her former colleagues are involved in the scheme, some of whom have already had informal chats about it, according to CNN. Among them include White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci, Miles Taylor, a former top Department of Homeland Security official, and Olivia Troy, an ex-advisor to former Vice President Mike Pence. Meanwhile, Select Committee member Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, has promised that the American people will be stunned when the House Select Committee on the attack delivers its report. America is going to be shocked and surprised at what we all come to learn this year, Congressman Jamie Raskin told CNN on Thursday night, 6th of January 2022, exactly 1 year after the violent and deadly insurrection at the Capitol. He also said that Stephanie Grisham gave him a lot of names I had not heard before and identified some lines of inquiry that had never occurred to me prior to her Wednesday interview with the committee. Separately, Stephanie Grisham on Thursday revealed she and more than a dozen of other former Trump officials are meeting next week to discuss how to stop the former President Donald Trump from succeeding in his attempt to destroy democracy and to get re-elected.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Just days into 2022, North Korea carried out a major weapons test. It launched a hypersonic missile this week, with North Korean media saying the projectile precisely hit its target at a distance of 700 kilometers. This was North Korea's second test of a hypersonic missile. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes and can achieve more than five times the speed of sound. Analysts say, however, the main feature of hypersonic weapons is not their speed, but their maneuverability makes them much harder to detect by radar. The North is currently part of a small group of countries, including the United States and China, in trying to develop hypersonic military technologies.
They have a plan. They have a plan that is public, there is no secret, is available. And so they have several devices, several weapon range that they want to develop. And one category is the hypersonic one.
The latest test firing came days after North leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said in a New Year's speech that Pyongyang would continue to strengthen its capabilities because the Korean Peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. North Korea tested different projectiles last year amid stalled talks with the United States and its southern neighbor. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries' presidents. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement, making Trump's approach towards North Korea another one of his major failures. North Korea has been subjected to Western sanctions for decades. Its relationship with the U.S. and its southern neighbors, South Korea and Japan, both staunch American allies, has been fraught with tensions for a very long time. North Korea is grappling with economic sanctions and chronic food shortages. Pyongyang has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
They managed to avoid any trouble to their economy, in the same way that many other countries that are under sanction they're doing. So basically they readjust their economy in a way that they can survive.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The U.S., which has been calling on North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, has left no stone unturned to isolate the communist state. But successive U.S. administrations have failed to force North Korea into submission. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration now says it is open to talks, but the North says that's implausible given the record of American hostile policies. The North seems too weary of American ulterior motives. What if it abandons its atomic arms and the U.S. does not drop its hostile policies and keeps up the pressure? This must be one of the key questions that comes to the North Korean leader's mind when he focuses on his country's relationship with America. The North insists that the White House has been determined to take and reluctant to give during past talks. It remains to be seen how Biden will act now to try to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
A new report has warned about the rising threat of extremism in the United States. The report has been prepared by the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. It says that 12 months after the attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob, far-right groups were traced and arrested by police and federal authorities. But it says other groups have reorganized, often with an emphasis on local-level politics. It found that domestic extremist groups have recruited and spread their messages through culture war debates, including vaccines, race, and education. It says groups such as Proud Boys and QAnon conspiracy movement have re-emerged in recent months. They have made progress by shifting to alternative online platforms, embracing rhetoric to engage more broadly with a mainstream conservative base, and engaging in new political activities, particularly public health and education issues at the local level. The report says extremist movements were filled with paranoia following the Capitol riot. It notes that members are suspicious of each other and law enforcement. That has discouraged many members from attending public events.
They morph into different forms and formations, but they tend to follow the same basic tenets, which are white nationalism. So whether we're talking about the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council or the Oath Keepers, white Southern Baptists or neo-Nazis, the American history is replete with these types of organizations.
These extremist groups have adopted smaller and less sophisticated platforms, and that made them vulnerable to data scrapes, breaches, and hacks. The report warns of the rise of far-wing influencers inside these alternative social media platforms and the dangers that they could bring. Far-right figures like the former top Trump aide Stephen Bannon have encouraged a precinct-by-precinct strategy. It refers to a ground-up approach that focuses on local politics.
In 2022, Ronald Reagan's so-called shining city on the hill has become exposed as a mirage, as the poor, the elderly, and people of color are still fighting in 2022 for one person, one vote.
The report comes as the U.S. prepares to remember the first anniversary of the Capitol Hill riot. During the January 6th riot, thousands of supporters of former President Donald Trump attacked police, vandalized the Capitol, and sent members of Congress and then Vice President Mike Pence running for their lives. Democrats have been arguing that the riot on January 6th was an insurrection based on disinformation spread by Trump, who alleges that he is the true victor of the 2020 presidential election and not Joe Biden.
As an economic system based on unbridled capitalism, the system eventually has to implode. The insatiable lust for markets, the insatiable lust for resources and profits cannot be sustained.
A new poll has found that 60% of Americans believe Trump's level of responsibility for the attack was either a great deal or a good amount. Trump is often cited by U.S. media as the one inciting his supporters to storm the Congress premises in the hope of overturning the election results. A committee tasked with investigating the events of the January 6 riot has issued dozens of subpoenas to Trump's current and former associates.
These folks are well-funded, they are very well-organized, but I don't think that they are in large enough number to where they can really take over the government in the manner in which, you know, in terms of a civil war and that kind of thing. I think that's a bit rhetorical. I think that's a bit of hyperbole.
At least 7 people died in the incident, including a police officer, and more than 700 have been arrested so far for crimes related to the breach.
Iranians have paid tribute to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, two anti-terror icons who were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike at the Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. People from all walks of life participated in ceremonies across Iran to mark the occasion. They called for bringing the perpetrators to justice. Addressing a gathering in the capital, Tehran, President Ibrahim Raisi said former U.S. President Donald Trump, who ordered the strike, must be put on trial.
The then U.S. President must be put on trial as an aggressor, murderer, and the main criminal. He must face divine retribution. If Trump, Pompeo, and other criminals are not tried in a fair court for their horrible crime and are not punished for their shameful acts, I tell all American statesmen, do not doubt, Muslims will take revenge.
Similar ceremonies were held in other countries too. People in Iraq, Yemen, Palestine, and Syria held vigils and paid tribute to the top generals.
So he's seen as someone who put the country first, who did whatever was necessary, whatever he was called to do for his country, he did. He was described by many as an unassuming man, he wasn't arrogant, and that led to his personal appeal. But he's seen as a great hero in Iran and the surrounding area, and his record in defending the country and in leading the troops in the different areas, different times, and even in peacetime, being responsible for at least some of the military in Iran, has left the people with great memories of him and great respect for him.
In Lebanon, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah Resistance Movement said the expulsion of all U.S. troops from the region will be the ultimate revenge for the assassination of Soleimani and Muhandis. Said Hassan Nasrallah hailed the two figures, saying they played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists in the region. Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations has urged the UN Security Council to hold the United States and the Israeli regime responsible for the assassination of Iran's anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani.
Given the dire implications of this terrorist act on international peace and security, the Security Council must live up to its charter-based responsibilities and hold the United States and the Israeli regime to account for planning, supporting, and committing the terrorist act. As I have on numerous occasions underlined, this internationally wrongful criminal act was a grave breach of the obligations of the United States under international law, and thus entails its international responsibilities.
Tahrawanchi stressed that General Soleimani played a significant role in combating international terrorism, calling his assassination a big gift and service to Daesh and other terrorist groups in the region. The Iranian diplomat noted that former head of the Israeli military intelligence, Major General Tamir Haiman, admitted last December
that Tel Aviv was involved in the 2020 assassination and described it as one of the two significant and important targeted killings during his term.
The United States, unfortunately, has veto power in the Security Council and continually defends Israel from accountability for its many crimes against humanity and international war crimes and gross violation of human rights. So the fact that Israel was involved in the assassination of General Soleimani, which was ordered and carried out by the United States, is something the Security Council will never hold Israel responsible for.
The former official was apparently referring to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, an Iranian nuclear scientist who was assassinated north of the capital Tehran in November 2020. Despite Iran's repeated calls on the international community to hold the perpetrators responsible for the dangerous adventurisms, neither the United Nations nor self-proclaimed promoters of human rights in the West have so far called for accountability or made any meaningful attempt to prevent similar attacks. Regardless, Iran has vowed to bring the perpetrators to justice and take revenge for the crimes they've committed.
Late Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was seen as a hero who stood up for the suppressed Muslims and Christians and people of other religions in Syria and Iraq, as well as other parts of West Asia. According to many Syrians and Iraqis, he was fearless, courageous, unselfish, and always present on the battlefield. General Soleimani was the spearhead of the fight against the U.S.-sponsored Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in West Asia. He was the strategic master of many battles against Takfiri terrorists in Syria. He played an important role in the liberation of the Christian-dominated regions from the grip of Takfiri terrorists in the country. Also, he had a great reputation in Iraq, where Daesh conquered large parts of the country. He managed to unite Sunni Kurds and Shia fighters in the battles against Takfiri terrorists. Therefore, for many Iraqis, he was a hero, like in Syria. General Soleimani was able to mark very important plans in line with providing regional security by preventing Daesh terrorists from overthrowing governments in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and other countries.
Daesh was actually an American and Zionist creation in order to destroy a number of Muslim countries as well as give a horrible image to Islam, because Daesh terrorists indulged in horrific crimes against innocent people. And so that project that the imperialists and the Zionists had launched, we saw how they erupted in Iraq in July of 2014, and by 2017, they were wiped out through the efforts of martyr General Qasem Soleimani.
General Soleimani was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike on January 3, 2020, while on a trip to the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. This raises the question, why should Washington kill the man who fought the terrorists in West Asia most successfully? General Soleimani was a powerful, strategic mastermind who revealed the ugly face of Western interference in both Syria and Iraq. His assassination exposed the U.S.'s support for terrorist groups and Washington's lies of countering terrorism. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was loved by people of the region as a defender of the oppressed, protecting Christians, Muslims, and those of other religions. Western-sponsored terrorist groups such as Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra sought to promote an image of Islam that was false. These groups were created by the Israeli regime and America with the financial support of Saudi Arabia. And General Soleimani was the one who confronted these deviant groups in Iraq and Syria. He managed to help the oppressed. He tried to save women, men, and children in Iraq and Syria from the crimes of Takfiri terrorists, no matter what faith they were from. He united Muslims and Christians and people of other religions in the fight against terrorists and once and for all defeated them.
Well, as Daesh's tactics included killing innocent people, kidnapping women and raping them, killing children and so on, these are things that have absolutely nothing to do with Islam. In fact, they are the very antithesis of the values of Islam that places a great premium on saving and protecting human life. So while Daesh and their backers were busy in killing innocent people, and with the deliberate policy, of course, of the imperialists and the Zionists to create a very violent and negative image of Islam, but the people, obviously, the targeted people were horrified by their actions, whether it was in Iraq or in Syria.
Millions of people in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and the rest of the world attended the funeral of General Soleimani. This shows that he is beloved by the West Asian nations and all the free people of the world.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Humanity is in need of Jesus Christ's teachings against oppression. Jesus Christ was equipped with the power of performing miracles and carried a divine message for humanity which saved them from the darkness of polytheism, atheism, ignorance, and oppression, and guided them towards justice, knowledge, and worshipping God. And this is the lesson which all Christians and Muslims who believe in the prophethood of Jesus Christ should learn. Today humanity is in need of those teachings more than ever before. The Virgin Mary was a young woman who stood firm against the accusations and suspicions of the people in her town and region, and she returned to her people holding her son in her arms. A girl came to a temple and stayed there until her youth. What factors and motivations caused her to resist all those temptations with such superhuman power? If her power was not superhuman, the issue would not be so greatly emphasized in the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran says she guarded her chastity, which means that she remained pure.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Islam taught us to behave in a fair way towards the followers of other religions. January 26, 2015. We have learned from Islam that we should behave in a fair way towards the followers of other religions. This is Islam's command to us, Today, what is witnessed in the world is that powers of those governments which claim to support justice do not at all behave in a fair way, except in the inner circle of their narrow, limited, and oppressive policies. Today you can see that in Europe and America they use massive propaganda against Muslims. The issue is not why Muslims do not have any freedom in many of these countries. Rather, the issue is why they do not have any security. The movie American Sniper, which has produced some reactions and which has been made by Hollywood, encourages a Christian or non-Muslim to harass Muslims as much as he can. In fact, according to what others have said, we have not seen this movie, it encourages such courses of action. This is not at all accepted by Islam. Islam believes in justice. On the issue of that attack on the city of Al-Anbar, the commander of the faithful, peace and greetings be upon him, said, "I have come to know that every one of them entered upon Muslim women and non-Muslim women." In this sermon, he says that some people have entered the houses of Muslims and Mu'ahida women. Mu'ahid means Jewish and Christian individuals who have formed an alliance with Muslims and who live under the protection of Islam, to take away their ornaments and harass them. Then Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "If any Muslim dies of grief after hearing all of this, he is not to be blamed. If a Muslim dies of grief at the harassment of non-Muslim women by the armies of the enemies and looters, they entered their houses and took away their ornaments, he is not to be blamed." This is the viewpoint of Islam.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
In the limelight.
The Netherlands has ended funding to the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, one of six Palestinian organizations recently declared as terrorist groups by the fake regime of Israel. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is titled "Dutch Double Standards: Punish Palestinians, Embrace Zionist Regime." Stay tuned for more. The Netherlands has ended funding to the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, one of six Palestinian organizations recently declared as terrorist groups by the fake regime of Israel. The implications of the Dutch move will reverberate throughout Palestinian civil society, which is under unprecedented attack by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime accuses the prominent human rights and social services organizations of serving as front groups for the Popular Front of the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party banned by the Zionist regime, the U.S. and EU. The targeted groups reject the Zionist regime's claims and have demanded that Tel Aviv provide the evidence that it claims justifies by the sweeping measure. Recently, the Zionist regime responded by saying that it would allow the groups to review only the unclassified material on which it is basing the designations. In its response, the Zionist regime's military attorney stated that The core of the declarations is based on classified, cross-checked, and reliable intelligence confirmation that cannot be disclosed, as it may harm security. The Zionist regime's response shows that the targeted groups are afforded no due process rights. Adala, a group providing legal representation to the banned organization, said recently. It also suggests that the Zionist regime authorities have no evidence linking them with illegal acts, and that this move amounts to the political persecution of human rights defenders. The terror designations leave the organization's staff vulnerable to arrest and their offices and property subject to closure and confiscation. The blacklisted group UAWC stated that given this context, the Dutch government was not abandoning it, but Palestinian civil society at large. The Dutch Foreign Ministry announced the decision recently after suspending aid to the group 18 months ago and following a year-long probe into possible links between the UAWC and the FPLP. That review examining the group's activities since 2007, when the Netherlands began funding the UAWC, yielded no evidence of financial flows between it and the PFLP. Nor has any proof been found of organizational unity between the UAWC and the PFLP, or PFLP providing direction to the UAWC, the Dutch Foreign Ministry states in an 8-page briefing to that country's parliament. While rejecting the Zionist regime's claim that the UAWC is an arm of the PFLP, the Dutch review found ties between individual staff and board members with the leftist group. The Dutch government is ending its funding on the basis of UAWC staff and board members' political affiliation in their personal capacities. The Netherlands is effectively punishing an entire organization and all its beneficiaries over alleged political sympathies of some of its staff and board members. The Foreign Ministry's briefing to the Dutch Parliament states that organizations will be asked how they deal with employees or board members who may be involved with groups that are on the EU and UN sanctions list. Palestinian resistance to the Zionist regime occupation, apartheid, and settler colonization has long been branded as unacceptable and criminalized. The U.S. designated the PFLP and other factions as terrorist groups as punishment for the rejection of the Oslo Accords signed by the fake regime of Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization in 1990s. UAWC said that the findings of the Dutch review reflect the group's status and existence as an independent organization which has no political or religious affiliation with any party or political organization. The group added that it cannot and would not interfere with the personal political beliefs and affiliations of its employees and board members. UAWC said it was shocked over the move based on alleged individual links resembling the toxic allegations of Israeli groups like NGO Monitor. Groups closely aligned with the Zionist regime, such as NGO Monitor, have for years published scurrilous accusations against Palestinian groups attempting to link them to proscribed political parties. The smear campaigns have resulted in onerous conditions on funding to Palestinian groups, curtailing their ability to carry out their work. So far, no government has come out in support of the Zionist regime's banning of the six Palestinian organizations it declared terror groups in October. But the U.S. and the EU have yet to explicitly condemn the move and demand that the Zionist regime revoke the designations. And as the Dutch abandonment of the UAWC shows, the Israeli declaration may have the intended effect of isolating the groups and drawing up their international funding. Three of the targeted groups, including Al-Haq, Al-Damir, and Defense for Children International Palestine, have submitted evidence to the International Criminal Court's war crimes investigation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip by the Zionist regime. That international tribunal is based in The Hague, the seat of the Dutch government. The UAWC was established in 1986 to support Palestinian farmers in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, facing Israeli land and water theft. The Zionist regime's illegal settlement activity is likely to be a primary focus of the International Criminal Court's investigation should it move forward. The Dutch government has been a leading donor to the UAWC since 2013, according to the group. The campaign to cut off Dutch funding to the group began in May 2019 when UK lawyers for the Israeli regime sent a letter to the Netherlands representative office in Ramallah with information about UAWC's supposed links to the PFLP. In June 2020, UK lawyers for the Zionist regime repeated those claims in a letter to Sigrid Kaag, Dutch development minister at the time, citing NGO Monitor as its principal source of information. UAWC said it was particularly saddened that the process leading to its disavowal was initiated by Kaag soon after her visit to the West Bank in early 2020, where she witnessed the relevance of the work. Kaag's oversight of funding to UAWC was used as a political cudgel by right-wing politicians in the Netherlands during that country's elections last year, as reported by more than 972 magazines. The UAWC said recently that the Zionist regime will seize the Dutch decision to further escalate its all-out attack on Palestinian civil society. All of this is diverting international attention from the Zionist regime's theft and its brutal suppression of the Palestinian people living under military occupation. The Dutch Foreign Ministry's briefing to Parliament mentions that the UAWC ended the employment of two staff members who were arrested by the Zionist regime in 2019 over their alleged involvement in a roadside explosion near a West Bank settlement that killed an Israeli girl and injured her brother and father. One of the arrested men, Samir Arbit, was hospitalized with life-threatening injuries after being tortured during his interrogation by Shin Bet, the Zionist regime's domestic intelligence agency. The Zionist regime prison authorities continued to interrogate Arbit while he was in intensive care, and a prison guard reportedly fired tear gas into his hospital room. Palestinian human rights organizations said that both Arbit and the other former employee, Abd al-Razak Faraj, suffered physical and psychological torture during interrogation. The Zionist regime's attorney general closed an investigation into Arbit's brutal interrogation early last year. Independent UN human rights expert condemned the Zionist regime's failure to prosecute, punish, and redress the torture and ill-treatment perpetrated against Arbit. The expert said, "We are alarmed that the use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques or exceptional measures during questioning reportedly led to a forced confession, which the universal prohibition of torture and ill-treatment aims to prevent." Concerning the broader attack on UAWC, which predates the arrest of two of its former employees, Palestinian groups stated in 2020 that UAWC is preventing the Palestinian presence on land that the Zionist regime wants to annex. That is why UAWC has been under attack for years. The Palestinian group said the Netherlands should investigate Dutch campaigns maintaining commercial relations with and profiting from illegal Israeli settlements. Instead, a Palestinian group supporting farmers and vulnerable communities across Palestine finds itself under review. In its letter to Parliament, the Dutch Foreign Ministry reiterated that the Netherlands funds Palestinian non-governmental organizations as part of the country's support for a two-state solution. The Zionist regime's current regime cabinet openly refuses to negotiate with Palestinians towards a two-state solution supported, at least in rhetoric, by the U.S., EU, and United Nations.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Pereza, London.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Scoos, and Sage Willoughby dubbed the Colston Four celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I just
been ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We illuminated history.
And this is a victory for Bristol. This is a victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the courts accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict.